All right, folks, this is going to be a really good podcast. Thanks for tuning in. My name is David Ellenbogen. This is NYC Radio Live. And my guest tonight is Banning Air. He came over to my apartment, so you will hear the occasional siren. Banning Air is author of multiple books. He's a including this new one, Lion Songs, and he wrote a great book called In Griot Time about Djelimari Tonkura. He wrote a book called Guitar Atlas. He's a musician as well, and hit me to some different styles, and that came in handy a lot when I ended up in Timbuktu. I already had a leg up on some of the local styles. Great guy, great musician, great writer, and he's got this great book on Thomas Mapfumo. And Thomas Mapfumo is this towering figure in Zimbabwean music and world music in general, and we'll be playing a lot of tracks and hearing this incredible story, which kind of parallels the story of Zimbabwe itself. And a few years back, I interviewed Thomas Mapfumo. So at the very end of this interview, of this podcast, after you hear all this great music and you hear all this insight from Banning Air, I'll play the entirety of that interview with Thomas Mapfumo. But just to get you excited, let's get a little taste of his irresistible music, and then we'll bring in Banning Air. All right, enjoy, and thanks so much for listening.
Zero, zero, zero. when people say the pitch, like you were giving the pitch to whoever.
The elevator
Duke
pitch.
Duke University. Eh? Yeah, yeah. Why the import? And then we'll get into his story.
Okay. The elevator pitch is that he stands among a small cadre of very important musician band leaders of Africa who not only developed a unique style that was a fusion of traditional music and modern music and something that he really could lay claim to as an original sound that has been continued beyond his work, but also he made a real difference in the history of the country. He contributed at many key points to capturing the national mood and even shaping the national mood and helping things to happen and bringing things to awareness that people either didn't want to look at or were afraid to look at or for whatever reason hesitated. He's had this knack for writing the right song at the right moment, the song that really gets people talking and stirs the pot and makes things move. So it's kind of the combination of those two things, the longevity, 40 years of amazing recordings, this very diverse but coherent style of music, and then these key points in history where he writes the song that really, as I say, hits the nail on the head for the mood of the country at that moment. And of course, he's been through, the book is divided into three sections because he began in Rhodesia. He had the sort of heyday of his career in the 1980s and 90s in Zimbabwe. And for much of the 2000s, he's been in exile in the U.S. So there are three sections, Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, America.
Right. So let's start it at the beginning. Can you paint a picture of Rhodesia as Thomas Mapfumo is coming into his own, early stages?
Yeah. He's born in 1945, which is really the height of Rhodesian power and control. There are two things that are really important to understand about Zimbabwe that kind of differentiate it from other African colonies. One is how quickly everything happened, how condensed the history is. Rhodes and his people really only come in from the Cape Colony, South Africa, into moving north into what is now Zimbabwe, looking for gold and diamonds. In the 1870s, that's very late. By that time, people on the coast of East Africa, certainly in South Africa and all through West Africa, have had centuries of contact with Europeans and Arabs. But the Shona people, from whom Thomas descends, really had very, very little contact. They were quite unprepared for what was going to hit them. And they were also somewhat diffuse at that time. They didn't have a central leader. It was a series of small city-states. So you start from there, and a mere 20 years later, you have the pioneers arriving, the original settlers, European settlers of Rhodesia, as it became called. And they very quickly, they did have to fight a little bit, not to take the land, but once they had it, there was a rebellion in the 1890s that they had to quell. And they did that in the classic sort of British fashion by turning the two major ethnic groups, the Shona and the Ndebele, against each other. They already had some friction, but the British were quite good at fanning those flames. And
how they go about doing that?
Well, the Ndebele had themselves only arrived relatively recently. They came as an offshoot of the Zulu Wars in South Africa in the 1830s. So they were already encroaching on land that the Shona wanted, and they were a much more militant, warlike people, so they were somewhat intimidating. And there was friction there to begin with, and the Rhodesians were master propagandists throughout their entire run in the country, and they would just seize on any story that made it look like the Ndebele were out to wipe out the Shona and displace them and subjugate them and all of that. So they fanned the flames of fear, and
like a newspaper.
in education. They were very, very concerned about education. See, the other thing that I was going to say that really distinguishes the Rhodesian period from, say, the British in Ghana or in Nigeria, where they really were just interested in cheap labor and resources, or they didn't even necessarily know what they wanted. They were just expanding the empire. The Rhodesians recognized, because Zimbabwe is a very beautiful, very lush, relatively disease-free country. You don't have malaria very much, or tsetse flies, or a lot of the things that were really big problems in the lower areas. It's a high plateau. It has a fabulous climate, great growing season. And these people were determined to live there. They were going to make their home there. This was a homesteading kind of operation, more like in South Africa. So that meant that they had to treat the local population somewhat differently, and it meant a lot of propagandizing, missionizing. Missionaries are a very important part of, not so much the divide and rule thing, but subjugating people, separating them from their traditional culture, teaching them that things that involve their ancestors and spirits and all the kinds of things that are bedrock to African religion were evil, work of the devil. And this ends up coming into the story of music, because the mbira, the instrument that is central to Shona's spiritual life and very important in Thomas Mapfumo's music, is associated with these rituals of possession, spirit possession, and contact with ancestors. And this was very, very systematically stigmatized by Rhodesian education and missionary activities. So long and short of that is they really got inside people's heads. They were manipulating them psychologically, and that combined with the short, compressed history, as I say, I mean, the Rhodesian state is really only fully operational when you get into sort of the 1920s. So by the time Thomas is born, it's really humming, but it hasn't been there that long. And then by the 50s and 60s, you're already starting to have the beginnings of nationalism. And the 70s is war, when Thomas is really making his original body of work musically, becoming a composer and an important popular singer. That's really in the context of a liberation struggle, a war. It's not exactly a civil war. It's really a rebellion, guerrilla war, a bush war, that eventually results in independence in 1980. So the whole thing is over in less than 100 years. It's an amazingly compressed and violent and intense history. And that, as I say, combined with this need to manipulate people's heads and the way they think about everything and their spiritual life, creates very extreme trauma. And that is really the context in which this whole story takes place.
Wow. All right. Wow. That's incredible. So let's get into the beginning. So Thomas is, when he's growing up, he's a teenager that you're talking about, the 1950s, 60s?
So he's born in 45. And a personal detail that's important is that he was born out of wedlock. His biological father could not pay the lobola, the bride price. So his mother took Thomas to live with her parents in what they call communal lands, the tribal trusts. This is land that has been set aside for Africans to live on. Although they were actually working on the farm that was owned by a white guy. But they were very far away from radios, television, news, popular music. They were really having his first 10 years had him a lot closer to the older, untouched traditional life than a lot of people of his generation. If you look at a lot of the other big popular singers of Zimbabwe that are of his generation, most of them have more urban childhoods than his. And I think this is important. I think it's part of the reason that he so reveres things about tradition, religious things, but musical things too, like the mbira. He remembers as a child being outside these mbira ceremonies and hearing what was happening inside and being fascinated and intrigued and loving the sound of the mbira, the sound of the drums, the way people sang. All of this stuff was really infused into him at a very early age. And then when he was 10, about, his mother had married Mr. Mapfumo. Mapfumo wasn't really his original name. So then he moves to the city and he has siblings and he's exposed to schools, buses, cars, police, people, and radio, principally radio, which he becomes fascinated by because the Rhodesian state uses radio as a very powerful tool of propaganda. And the way they get people to listen is by playing all the great pop music of the day, whether it comes from South Africa or Zaire at the time or England or, of course, the U.S. So he gets a very rapid musical education when he comes to the city of Harare.
Right. Wow, that's amazing. It's amazing how it's like a metaphor for the history of the country. As his early years was very traditional, and then a very rapid jump into this colonial, urban kind of thing. Okay, and so he makes his earliest, I want to get into some music. So he makes his earliest musical statements, and he's playing in kind of like bars, that kind of...
Yeah, well, he starts out... A lot of the popular music of the 50s and 60s is coming out of Bulawayo, which is the Ndebele-dominated city going towards South Africa. And it tends to be kind of... It's got a lot of jazz in it because South Africa was nuts about jazz in those days, and they'd sing a lot of, like, exact covers of things sung by American jazz groups, Mills Brothers and things like that, except they would just put them into their local language. So there was a whole Shona Ndebele version of that going on in Zimbabwe and Rhodesia. But at this time, rock and roll is hitting, and young people who go out and hear music are starting to hear Elvis and all this kind of thing. And so Thomas would tend to get hired by bands, like one of the first famous bands he played with was called the Springfields. They were a big popular band in Salisbury, now Harare, but that's what it was called then. And he was hired as the rock and roll singer. He was the guy who was going to sing all these new songs, Elvis and Ray Charles and whatever it might be. So that was his first job. And he did play in a lot of bars and town halls and that sort of thing. And then he ends up getting a job at a mine in the northern part of the country, the Mangura Mine. And he's in this band that was called the Hallelujah Chicken Run Band, which was the first band that he actually started writing songs for. He was just a singer. It wasn't his band. But he started writing songs, and he had this idea that it was important to sing in Shona, it wasn't unheard of, but it was unusual. Not very many popular singers were singing in Shona. Outside of these jazz covers, the popular entertainment bands tended to sing in English, and that was
which the radio was more than happy about. Probably,
yeah. And they would just be doing covers of popular songs,
right?
So he starts writing songs, and there's a key moment that kind of launches the whole thing. It's probably 1972 or 3. They go into a studio. They win a contest. The Hallelujah Chicken Run Band. At the Skyline Motel in Harare, and this producer hears them and says, okay, I'm going to bring you into a studio to record. And they record 7 songs, and one of them is based on a traditional Mbira song. It's a guitar adaptation that he created with one of his principal guitarists over the years, Joshua Lomai Dube, who was a good friend of mine. And they create this song together, and somewhat to Thomas's surprise, it turns out to be the hit. And there have been other groups that have adapted traditional Shona songs, but this song, partly it's called, we can hear it, it's called Ngoma Yarira, which means the drums are sounding. And drums sounding sends off a trigger in the minds of traditional people that war is coming. Mm. So it's both tapping into this tradition that's been stigmatized by Rhodesian missionary and education activity, but also subtly suggesting that something's about to happen. And that combination of things makes this song a huge hit. And that's the beginning of a whole series of songs that are referred to now as the Chimurenga singles. Chimurenga being a Shona word loosely translated as struggle, but really it's referring into deep into Shona lore about a person who fought for the Shona people. So that's how it starts, Ngoma Yarira.
All right, let's check it out.
Thank you.
So, for those who know Thomas Mapafumo's music, or as they continue listening to this program, they'll see that a lot of it's there. A lot of his, the signature thing, like you were saying, that the muted guitar playing, which is kind of an imitation of the thumb piano in Bira, the kind of bass lines that no Western person would ever imagine.
Exactly, yes. And, which also comes from Bira, where the bass lines tend to follow the melody, and as opposed to hitting on the downbeats, they tend to be sort of offbeat. So you hear that.
Right.
And also that way of singing, the two voices. Thomas's is actually the second voice, the answering voice in that song. But the way they're interspersing is right out of Mbira music, and it's, as you say, it's something, it's a kind of a vocal arranging that you hear throughout his work right up to the present.
Right, and of course this kind of lilting, kind of 6-8 kind of rhythm, which comes from that Shona tradition, which I guess we can get into a little more deeply. But as you said, it's used by spirit mediums for somewhat, you know, possession ceremonies. And,
And as time goes on in the 70s, Thomas is really, it's interesting to look at pictures of him in that time. There's a couple in the book, just how his persona changed so radically. I mean, he would, some days he would dress up like a dandy with like shiny shirt and all this stuff, the glasses and the pendant, you know, like he's stepping right out of, Brooklyn at the time, you know. And the next day he's dressed like a spirit medium and he's got a staff and he's taking on the whole sort of persona of one of these people who stands between the living and the dead, you know. And he never, there was some confusion at the time as to whether people actually thought that he was a spirit medium. He never said that or thought that, but there are people to this day, particularly in Bira, certain Mbira players who really think that he actually was getting his songs from the spirits and all this sort of thing. But it's just, he's trying on all these different personas, which is very interesting.
And just the act of playing local music is a rebellious idea. Are the seeds of revolution in the country, are they already, or even in mental revolution, are they in the air yet?
Yes, yes. By the time he makes that song, there's already been what a lot of people consider to be the first skirmishes of the war. It's not a war that starts at a particular moment. Different people put the beginning at different times. Some people would put it as far back as 1966, the Battle of Chinoy, where there was a fight between rebels and the government. But But there was an attack, I believe it's 1972, on a farm, which begins a constant drumbeat of violence, popping up here, popping up there. It's a guerrilla war. It's not like armies against each other at that point. Although it becomes more that way as it goes on, when you have the forces really gathering in Zambia and Mozambique, across the borders, in these independent African countries who are sympathetic to the liberation movement and allow these armies to build up there. And one of the really important things about Thomas's music during that period is that you have many testimonies, some in the book, of people who literally were inspired to go and join those guerrilla forces by hearing his songs. So he really is making a very concrete contribution to the struggle. And the songs are very interesting because they're playing a complicated game. Aside from the traditional music that's brought in and the whole the power that has on urban people, reminding them of their rural past and of their ancestry and of this culture that's been oppressed and even stolen from them. That's powerful. But in addition to that, there are these lyrics that are rarely right out on the surface saying, go join the struggle, but they're suggesting it in so many ways, and they're very artful, and they use proverbs, and they're literally designed so that some people will get the message. Even Shona speakers, some people will get the message and some people won't. A great example is a song after the Hallelujah Chicken Run Band, the contest and all that. Thomas comes back to Harare, and he has a good run with another band that's not his, a band called the Acid Band, and they really kind of perfect this whole traditional adaptation approach. But also he becomes their star singer because he's a great singer, and also he's writing these very interesting songs. One of them that's very important comes near, well into the conflict, near the end of the war, 1977. Ian Smith is the president, and he has declared Rhodesia to be separate from England, its own country, because England had given up its colonies, and it would have given up Rhodesia if it could have, but they declared a unilateral independence. Ian Smith didn't. And he said in a famous speech, there will never be a black majority government in this country, not in 1,000 years. And so Thomas writes this song called Pamoro Mochete, which means that's just talk, or it's mere talk. And he never says that's what it's about. But some people get it and some people don't. It's that thing again. And it's a great song. We could hear that too. You really hear in this song that he's found his voice and he's got
all
this.
All right, well, you know what? Like, let's jump ahead.
Let's hear a bit
get
of that.
A taste, yeah.
Pamro mochete, aye aye, abambo. chicken. We never made no mambo. But no shoe bigger. Vamos a van a ziba de curara. Vamos a dar a pão no siga. Vamos a van a mari. Vamos a van a zogu pega. Vamos a van a mudar na massa carregada. Se não tem tu gabiri nem babo. O que tem o pai de saco pudir na baguara.
That was in 1973 when I went to Mangura. Mangura is a place where they mine copper. We went there to form a band, and the band was called Hallelujah Chicken Run, because most of the band members were working at the Chicken Run. Well, Hallelujah Chicken Run was a new band, and with new music, with new ideas, we decided to compose our own music, which we decided to call Afro Rock. There was only one tune that was not Afro rock. It was Zimbabwean traditional tune. Out of all the singles that we recorded, that single, that record, is the only one that people accepted, because this record was militant. It was about the war.
da tove rumbi. Aye iwe, ele da tove rumbi ine. Aye iwe, wola da tove rumbi. Aye iwe, wola da tove rumbi. Inga zwenyo maga karika mune zimba zine moto. Inga zwenyo maga karika muno jikari no pisa. Inga zwenyo maga karika mune pegu rara. Inga zwenyo maga karika mune mare muomwe.
So we heard a couple of songs there, and the voice of Thomas Mafumo as well. And first of all, what we talked about the first song, but what was that last song that we just heard?
Yeah, that last one, it was great to hear that. That's Fumbu Parozeva, which means hardship in the rural areas. And he's kind of listing all the difficult conditions that people are having to put up with in the countryside. And it's the sort of song it doesn't point fingers at of blame exactly. It talks about how much people are suffering, but the one line in it, the one word in it that kind of tricks it is when he talks about land being taken. So you know, people in the government or censors could think, oh well, he's you know it could be as much a criticism of the guerrillas as of the army, right? because they're also tormenting people in the rural areas and creating all this hardship and deprivation. But when he talks about land being taken, that kind of, just with that one word, situates it within the whole history of all this stolen land, which is really the fundamental crime of the Rhodesians. And the thing that to this day is still being they're trying to work out in Zimbabwe.
But somehow throughout his history, he tends to slip past the censors, right? He tends to slip past a lot of things.
Not so much anymore, but okay. Yes, it's true. The song that finally really tips the balance is another funny story. I don't actually have it here, but it's called the translation is "Send Your Children to War," and it's actually a Rhodesian Air Force marching song, and he didn't really change the words at all. But because it's him singing it, it seemed really, and that was finally, you know, the bells went off, and that was the point at which he got detained. This is 1979, right at the end of the war. He's detained, questioned, kind of absurdly.
Right.
There's a funny bit in the book where he talks about all these records being thrown in front of him, even records that aren't even his records. And they say, look, are you the Chimurenga singer? You're the one who's causing all this trouble. You know, but it was actually kind of a scary situation. Potentially, he didn't know what was going to happen. And they did intimidate him and eventually released him on the condition that he sing at a rally for Bishop Muzurewa, who was he was kind of Ian Smith's last ditch effort to kind of come halfway, you know, have a weak president that he could control who wasn't with the guerrillas.
And the bishop was an African guy.
Yeah, he was an African bishop.
But he was willing to kind of be the lackey of Ian Smith in this.
That's the way a lot of people spun it. It's complicated. I mean, he was a man of the cloth. He didn't believe in violence. But he did believe in independence, and he had been very active in the nationalist movement.
Right.
But Smith just sized him up as a more palatable option than someone like Robert Mugabe or Joshua Nkomo, who was the Ndebele leader in Zambia. So you had sort of the Shona army in Mozambique and the Ndebele army in Zambia. and they have all their own complications and issues. Right. But between the two of them, they were both terrifying to the white Rhodesians. So,
right.
So Muzorewa, but the Muzorewa thing didn't last. He was elected, but no foreign government recognized the selection, and the war got much worse.
Right.
As soon as he was elected, a lot more people being killed, and it was very early on in his regime that they realized they were going to have to go back to the table and come up with something different. So, and this is a tough thing for Thomas because he had been sort of manipulated into being associated with that brief regime. It undermined his credibility with a lot of the hardcore guerrillas.
Right.
And he had, after independence came in 1980, he had some work to do to rebuild his reputation. He did it actually quite quickly, but he was asked many, many years later what the hardest thing in his life had been, and he immediately said that year, that time,
right,
when people didn't believe in him and they thought he'd sold out.
Because he's kind of the ultimate not sellout, you know, maybe, perhaps brilliantly, they figured out a way to paint him as such. Or
It's hard. I never could really get. I even interviewed Muzorewa. He was still alive when I was writing the book, and I met him once, and he professed ignorance about all of this. Other people arranged the music at my concerts, and I suspect if he was singing at my rally, it was because he believed in. You know, he didn't.
Right, right.
He didn't seem to know the story very well.
Yeah.
And Thomas is immediately, no, he's lying. You don't forget something like that.
That's a great impression. So anyway, I do want to jump back a little bit I think the one kind of important thing that we didn't touch on is that, as things are intensifying, and as you said, that people are actually starting to go to other countries and forming kind of militias or to fight the Rhodesian government, Thomas actually goes out to he actually gets smuggled into those territories.
There's a famous moment when the guerrillas kind of arrange a meeting with him, and he's taken to a place, and they have to march, and it's all these tactics to avoid being detected, and he has this meeting with the guerrillas, and it's the kind of thing that if he'd been caught, he would have been killed. I mean, there just would have been the end of the story right there. So but also, the other thing that's important about it in terms of the activities of his band at that time, that was still during the time of the Acid Band, I believe. The Blacks Unlimited, the band that he has had ever since, is formed in 1978, so very near the end of the war. But I think that was still the Acid Band then. And they were told by the guerrillas not to travel with truck convoys, which is what they had been doing in the past because they thought that was safer. When they're going around to do their gigs around the country, they were traveling with these truck convoys, mm-hmm. and they were saying, no, we're going to be attacking those convoys now. You don't want to be doing that.
Wow.
So he actually got useful information out of it and took a big chance. It actually just happened one time, as far as I know.
Right.
He always talks about that one meeting, you know, it made a big impression on him seeing all these. One of the things about the Chimurenga fighters is that they all took on fake names, Chimurenga names,
right.
You know, Chairman Mao, Jimi Hendrix. It was just part of the sort of the lore, their practice,
right.
You know.
And also, I mean, we should mention that the leader of the resistance at this time is Robert Mugabe.
Yeah, he's the leader of one of the two.
Okay.
There's ZAPU and ZANU. He was the ZANU leader.
Okay.
In Mozambique.
And his figure obviously it comes up throughout the whole life.
Yeah.
His fate and Thomas Mafumo's fate
are deeply intertwined.
Yes, and complex.
Yeah, very.
So at this time, Mafumo is getting smuggled off into Mugabe territory. Is that correct?
Well, no, not into Mozambique. No. That was within Zimbabwe, the place that he went. Mugabe at that time is still in Mozambique.
Okay.
Commanding. And Mugabe had been in prison for 10 years. There's a lot of murky stuff about the deep military history of this war. I mean, there's a question surrounding how is it that he was able to, once he was released from prison after 10 years, so quickly get across the border into Mozambique. And some people speculate, well, they they wanted that to happen for one reason or another. And, you know, there was a lot of intrigue. Some of the other key leaders of the struggle who might have been serious rivals to Mugabe died mysteriously in car accidents or this and that. And there are to this day people who think that Mugabe engineered all this stuff. There's no real hard evidence of it, but he is very smart, very ruthless, very cunning, amazingly.
Yeah.
You know, a guy with just totally ruthless tactics and amazing survival instincts.
And he's still calling the shots.
Yeah, here he is in his 90s, is he? 95, yeah, or something, about 95.
Wow. And you paint a pretty amazing psychological portrait of him. So he had some horrible scarring incidences.
Yeah, when he was young. Yeah, that's true.
Well,
he was raised in a place called Zimba, that was he was in a Jesuit town, and his father was one of these traditional people who really resisted missionary training, and he pissed off the Jesuits quite a bit to the point where they forced him and his family to live far outside the town. And two of his brothers, Robert's brothers, became very sick and actually died because they weren't able to get to medical attention quickly enough. And in his shame about that, the father left and went and married another woman in Bulawayo and showed up years later and promptly died. And so Robert, from early teens, became the head of the household with all these chips on his shoulder and all this bitterness. And he doesn't really show much signs of having been very political. He went to school. He was very studious. He worked really hard. He was really super disciplined. But he went to Ghana shortly after independence there, and he experienced the sort of Afro-celebratory you know, optimism and hopefulness of the Nkrumah years.
Right.
Negritude and all of this was in the air. And he was very much impressed and imprinted by that. And he met his first wife there and brought her back. And it was at that time in the early 60s that he begins to emerge as a spokesperson and a leader within the liberation struggle. And that's when he gets arrested and spends 10 years in jail and gets released in the 70s to go and fight in Mozambique. So that's kind of the backstory on him. When he was elected in 1980, different people had different impressions of him. I mean, people in like the Smith regime had a pretty good idea that this was kind of a scary guy. People in the country were elated. Thomas himself felt very good about him at that time, although he did say in some interviews later on that he had some doubts about Mugabe's embrace of Marxism, which he didn't really buy. But, you know, it was a fairly minor objection at the time.
And people were thrilled. They had an African leader for an African country suppression. And
a very articulate one who spoke very, very generous and beautiful words at the independence celebration in 1980.
Right.
And people around the world had great hope for him. They thought, wow, this is a guy who's really on the ball. He's incredibly smart and well-educated and experienced and articulate. And he's going to show how African independence should work. There was all this. I remember this. I was just coming out of college at that time, and I was very interested in this.
You're a big pro-Mugabe.
Oh, well, you know, it wasn't. I didn't really even see it as in those terms because I hadn't really been following everything came before. But I thought, well, this is a very interesting, you know, person to appear on the international scene.
Yeah.
You know, it took a long time for people to cotton to how ruthless and violent he was.
Yeah.
You know, he in the early years he was very afraid of Undebele uprising in that part of the country, and he basically enforced a news blackout and sent these effectively special forces down there and just murdered and intimidated and pillaged and raped and did horrifying things that the world never really quite knew about until quite a bit later. And even when it all came to light some years later and Mugabe appointed a special commission to look into it and then never made the findings public to this day. So it was left to the a Catholic commission to do their best to piece it together. And they estimate that, I think the figure is 30,000 people were killed. So,
wow.
You know, so you don't have to look much further than that to realize. And then this whole thing that we've heard a lot about in the last decade or so, where he gets these kind of vigilante youth mobs to go and intimidate the opposition whenever there's an election. He actually was doing that right from the beginning. He did that in every election. But it was kind of not really noticed in the chaos of that mm-hmm. first election. And in subsequent elections, he won so easily that it was kind of a footnote. But whenever there was any doubt that he was going to win, the gloves came off.
Wow. So we should just mention that in that celebratory moment
yes. where
that Bob Marley showed up with his right. his freedom songs, Zimbabwe.
Yes.
And actually, there's a great story. I suppose this is it. Did tear gas bombs
oh, yes.
go off?
That's it.
Yeah, yep. So if I'm sure you've read, is it Peter White's, something White's book?
White, yes, oh goodness!
You probably know him.
Yes, I certainly do. How could I forget his name? I knew him personally. He's not around.
Timothy
anymore.
White.
Timothy White. There you go.
Yeah, Timothy White's book. You know how he describes that Bob Marley is on stage and you know the tear gas bombs go off and he's the last one off because
yes.
he really is in a state when he
yeah.
plays. He really is kind of it.
Yeah.
And of course they're like, this is madness. This is you know.
Well, it's a funny moment because the reason that happens, people didn't know that Marley was going to be there. It was arranged pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
and he shows. The stadium is right very near the big townships where so many people live, and they heard this huge PA system blasting Bob Marley. They couldn't believe it. So people started mobbing the stadium, and they broke through the barriers, and they mm-hmm. were actually coming in. And so the police did what they had done in such situations all through the war, which was that they just like went crazy with the tear gas. But meanwhile, you've got all these heads of state and
right.
dignitaries from all over the world in there, and they're all like choking. And it was a very strange moment in the midst of all this.
Right. You have all the world leaders are there.
Yeah.
Like all the
yeah.
presidents. And
yeah. Yeah. It's a huge, huge gathering. Very, very significant landmark moment in African history. And it's marred by this absurd overuse of tear gas. But you know what, it's interesting because I've interviewed so many people about that gathering and their memories tend to be confused. One of the reasons they are is because Marley was so disappointed with the way that turned out that he played another concert the next night, a free concert. And some people have their memories are all confused between the two concerts, you know.
Right.
So I had trouble sorting that out. But he did another concert later, which is not, I don't think that's really widely known, but people who were there know.
Yeah, I think there's a bootleg floating around of that.
There are bootlegs of the you can find clips on yeah. YouTube of the independence celebration.
Okay. Wow. Well, okay. So let's hear some music. The Blacks Unlimited are for us.
Oh, yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, maybe since we're talking about this joyful moment, we should probably play the song Chao Yo Chiri Zeva, which means traditional life has returned. And it's this very celebratory song. It's just got this incredible. This is actually the first Mafumo song I ever heard, and I was immediately hooked. It's just so joyous and giddy, and he at the end he shouts out praise for Robert Mugabe, and it's a moment.
All right, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Here with Banning Air, the author of Lion Songs, Thomas Mafumo, and the Music That Made Zimbabwe. It's a great new book. I really, really tore right through this one thing, man.
That's great.
Fun reading it.
Yeah, we're hearing tunes from the companion CD, Essential Tracks in the Making of Zimbabwe, also called Lion Songs.
Right, and on this one, you know, you're talking about the celebration. One unique thing about this track is like, I almost hear the smile on his face when he's singing.
Yeah, that's rare
because a lot of times it feels like there's a warning. You know, he's getting into a spooky territory, this kind of thing. But here it's a happy Thomas.
Totally joyous, yeah.
From your portrait of his characters, you know, it seems like it's not always the case.
It's definitely not always the case, but there is actually, he's actually kind of, a lot of the time, his, you know, when not being irritated by the world, he's very lighthearted. He loves to just tell stories and laugh and joke. You know, actually, that's mm-hmm. that's really his kind of natural state.
That's his default state. Yeah,
he's really kind of an upbeat guy, although he can be incredibly stern and you know. overbearing in his moral judgment and all of those kinds of things. He's got a lot of dimensions, but it's at heart, he's really quite a lighthearted fellow.
Wow. Well, that's great to hear. I found that in your portrait of him. I also got the impression of, as you said, like, you know, he would say in his band that there was a certain order that the spliff would always go around, you know, that yeah, the status.
That's Tom Terrell, who was one of his better road managers.
Oh, that's him.
Great stories about that first U.S. tour. That's what that's from. Yeah.
But that kind of portrait, seems similar in terms of some of these other kind of superstar African musicians who have parallel life stories. I mean, a fella so similar in that.
Even much more extreme in Fela's case. But
yeah, we might, a huge, like, you know, obviously a leader, created his own genre.
Yeah.
He definitely, people were under his thumb in a sense. You know, people have
he
been
ruled
his bands.
That band with an iron fist, yes.
You know, I've heard stories of, that you couldn't quit that band if you just wanted to. It wasn't that easy. You know?
No. Phil is on another whole level. But you're right that they're both. I mean, the way Thomas Hall describes it is that household that he grew up in with his mother and his stepfather was incredibly strict, and there was just all these rules and all the strictness, and he, despite his freewheeling rock and roll, you know, joking nature, maintains that very, very, very disciplined sense of how order and how things should be. I mean, it wasn't at the same level of kind of, I mean, with Fela, it reaches a level of kind of twisted abusiveness, you know. But with Thomas, it's just a really strict sense of order and decorum and hierarchy, you know. Who has control over what? Who has final word of what? And that's an issue that comes up throughout the story and to the present day even.
Right, and you got to play with him.
Oh yeah.
So you saw the inner workings of that band, and
I met him in 1988, January of 1988. So, you know, we've sort of taken the story up to 1980. The 80s are very interesting time for the band, because once they get past the stigma of the Muzarewa thing, where he was associated with this supposedly sellout attempt to have halfway independence, he quickly becomes, again, the most popular musician in the country, and just terrific bands, putting out just amazing songs one after another. And a lot of the early stuff in the 80s, early 80s, is about rebuilding the country and working hard and just, you know, very optimistic stuff. Mm-hmm. But increasingly it starts to creep in more and more songs about how hard life still is and how much trouble people are facing and problems they're having. But it was right in that time that we first went there. I went there with Sean Barlow with Afropop Worldwide, and he was one of our really, you know, people of interest in Africa, and particularly in Zimbabwe. And so we spent a bunch of time with the band, did long interviews, and got a real sense of it. And I was fascinated with that guitar style, that whole, all the guitar stuff, but particularly the adaptation of Mbira music onto guitar, the muting and the kind of flat pick work where you're jumping over strings to create the impression of a larger, like a thumb piano, where you can be playing high and low melodies at the same time. And they had these ways of jumping around with the pick, so you get that feeling. And I just was like completely into that. And the band was very nice to me and taught me stuff. And so I think it was even on one of the tours. I don't know if it was the first tour or the second tour in 91 when I first got on stage with them during a sound check and just played a couple of songs with them. And it was really fun. And Thomas encouraged, and they encouraged. And then I went back in 92, end of 92 into 93, and spent a lot of time actually hanging out with the guitarists and learning stuff and played a bunch of shows with them. And then over time, by the late 90s, I was kind of more comfortable with the band, and I actually was on some recordings. We even created a song together in 1998 when I was living there. So, yeah, so that's been
a
sort of... And
you played Carnegie Hall.
Yes,
you did it.
True.
You did it. Look, Mom.
Yeah, really.
You know how crazy... You thought I was so crazy going to Africa.
Practicing. Just be friends with Thomas Mafumo. Anyway, yeah. No, that's been a lot of fun. And also, it's really given me a lot of insight into how the band works, because every band, you know, has their own method of composing. And with Thomas, it's a very organic kind of thing. I mean, he when he's working on a song, that band practiced a lot. I've never seen a band work so hard. When I was living there in 97, 98, they were playing 5 shows a week, and a show would start at 8:30 and never finish before 3:30 in the morning. And then they would go and show up and rehearse the next day. And so it was just like a complete lifestyle of music.
That's good. Just 12 hours of
craziness.
Music a day.
I mean,
or
so insane. And when the way he would write a song is, he would have an idea. Everyone would sit around in a circle, you know, minimal amplification. People are just singing into the air, amps turned way down low for the guitars, the horns off a bit so they're not too loud. And he would just go around. They'd start the song and play it for like an hour, not without stopping. And he would just go around to each person and listen to what they were playing and make little refinements. He plays a bit of guitar, but he's not really an instrumentalist. But he was a composer who would use the band as his instrument effectively and just tune each one and tell each one what he wanted until he got it the way he wanted. And then they'd record it on a little cassette player, and that would be the demo, and it would go from there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing opportunity that you got to.
Yeah, yeah. It was really
be on the inside like cool. That.
Yes, I agree.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So let's hear now prime Blacks Unlimited during this period. And basically what's happening, as you said, is that he's huge, but he's rubbing up, he's becoming a gadfly.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and yeah, so there's actually two songs that maybe we can hear them back to back. The first one is the song that really changed his relationship with the government, 1989, just after we visited. There was a big scandal that broke where it was revealed that Mugabe's ministers were basically getting BMWs as part of their compensation, but then they were buying extra ones and selling them on the black market. And it was corruption. And it was revealed in great detail by an investigative reporter in a series of articles. And it really, really rocked the nation. And Thomas quite bravely wrote this song called Corruption, which isn't a traditional song at all. He sang it in English, and it's kind of a quasi-reggae song. And it actually became the title of his first big international release, because right at that time he was signed to Mango, which is a division of Island, Chris Blackwell, all of that. And it was kind of ironic that the great, you know, muse of the liberation struggle has his moment of being introduced to the larger world, and it's singing a song called Corruption, which is criticizing the very man that he helped to bring to power. So it was a lot to chew on. and that's how that was his kind of role. And it was his biggest hit since independence. So it was a hugely popular song, and it's a very catchy song. We can hear that. It's quite long. I don't know if you want to play the whole thing, but then the other one is more to demonstrate the musical direction of the band, which was actually going even deeper in tradition, and now they were starting to actually use mbira in addition to guitar and keyboards, and really making the band really kind of what I used to refer to as a folk orchestra, because it would be like 16, 17 people on stage, and percussionists, singers, dancers, mbira players, guitarists, you know, I mean, really, really rich, lush sound, and that song is called Magariro, which is all about, again, raising this question of like, who are we if we've lost our culture? You know, what are we passing on to future generations if we're just running away from our culture? And this really becomes the central part of his message. It isn't so. I mean, the corruption and the politics are there, but in a way, the really central part of his message over time is more this thing about valuing culture and trying to figure out what to keep and what to throw away from tradition, and to really think about that and talk about that and bring that into the conversation, as opposed to just carrying on this whole colonial hangover of being afraid of and ashamed of your culture. So, Corruption and Magariro.
Something for but something. Nothing for nothing. Something for 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 something. Nothing for nothing.
something for something, nothing for nothing.
I'm here with Banning Air, the author of Lion Songs. He's and the companion recording, Lion Songs, Thomas Mafumo, and the music that made Zimbabwe. It's a really excellent book. He's going to be doing a reading next Saturday at Bar Bez. I'm sure you'll be playing a little music.
Yeah,
too,
I'll play, and I'll do a little audio-visual presentation. Oh, you see a couple of video clips and some images.
What time is that going to be?
8 to 9:30. Great. And then I'll play guitar at the end.
That's one of the great rooms. It is.
I love doing this there. And I play there semi-regularly and did a gig with my group, Timbilo, where I said a few words about the book. And they said, oh, you should come and do a proper reading here. So,
nice.
So that's what we're doing on December 12th, next Saturday.
Great. All right. So I am a sucker for the Imbira. I think you actually steered me in that direction after our first radio interview.
Yeah.
And since then, yeah, I've gotten to meet Thomas and Chartwell through you, and got to interview Forward Quenda and one more killer, the guy from the Soul of the Imbira albums.
Cosmos Magaya.
Yeah, Cosmos Magaya. Yeah. Came to the station. We did a good thing.
He's a great guy. Yeah, so, they're really interesting people.
Interesting people, incredible tradition. One of the great traditions, right?
Yeah. Really deep. Always, every encounter is always offers something new. You know, you never really get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. All right. So we are kind of been going through Thomas Mafumo's story, and all right, now he's really pushing it, and it amazes me how musicians, the power of music, really, because in a set, he's really the only guy who can get away with doing what he's doing, it seems.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, well, he would always encourage other people to do it. He felt that they just weren't brave enough or ambitious enough.
Right.
He was always the one saying, you know, come on, guys. And even, well, you know, now, of course, the third big part of the story is his exile. And the exile is really, corruption is 1989, all through the 90s. And I lived there for six months in 97 and 98. Thomas is in a position of an interesting cat and mouse game with the national leaders and the national media, where it's a little hard and even emotionally painful for them to attack him because he's so woven into their origin story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those songs of the 70s are so much a part of the story of the war and the experience of the war that it's very hard to realize that this person who created all that such important music is now the one who's pointing fingers and saying, you're corrupt and you shouldn't be in power anymore. And you should let younger people come in and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, ZANU doesn't allow independent voices. That's Mugabe's party. All these songs that are just criticizing. But it really comes to a head just after the time I lived there, 99 and 2000, when Mugabe basically backs the vigilante campaign to seize white farms. And Thomas basically calls it for what it is as a suicide move, because if you just take the farms, destroy them, put all these black workers out of work, and then just give these huge commercial farms to, you know, government cronies and political insiders, he says very clearly. We can hear this quote from him where he basically says, you've harvested hunger. And then there's this beautiful song that he created after he pretty much moved his family to Eugene, Oregon, which was in 2000. And in 2001, he records the song Mari Manzara, which means you've harvested hunger, a beautiful Mbira-based song. And he just lays out this case. And that's just too much. They can't take that because they're so invested, the government is so invested in this land seizure campaign, and when he attacks,
because it's a populist move.
Yes, and they co-opt all these singers and they have them make records and make these jingles that they play endlessly on the radio supporting the campaign, and Thomas is pointing fingers at those people and calling them sellouts, and it's really gets hot in the early 2000s. And that eventually leads to his decision not to go there anymore. He hasn't been there since 2004. Although at this point, I'd say it's very soon that he may go back there. It gets closer mm-hmm. all the time. He's been playing in Mozambique and South Africa this year.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a matter of time before he plays there again. But it's been since 2004. That's a long
right.
time.
And you say that on one of his last visits, it gets really scary. You know, they said there's some quote from, you know, some guys say, today we take out the old man or something that. Yeah. It seems like.
There are all these threats and confrontations and legal cases. You know, they accuse him of stealing BMWs and there's all these stratagems that are deployed and he finally just decides. I mean, I think that it's important to say that the decision to move his family, which actually he did before he himself stopped going back, mm-hmm. was more about thinking that this is just not a good place for his kids to be. They were just hitting, you know, into high school and university age, and he just said, "Yeah, I don't want my kids growing up in this."
Right.
There's violence. There's terrible financial issues that are causing schools and hospitals to be
right.
closed, and he just felt
the
like
farms
he wanted.
Are not productive.
He kind of made the decision to value his family over his career because I think it's. Some would disagree with me, but I think it has not been good for his career to go into exile. It's made it
right.
much harder to reach the audience that cares about him most, and it's made him just less present in the
yeah.
minds of young Zimbabweans, and that's now a long time, almost
right.
going on a generation. And that was a terrible sacrifice, but he has no regrets because he really, at the end of the day, he'll tell you every time he's a family man, you
yeah.
know?
Oh, that's a beautiful thing. And Well, one thing, I do love the story, and I love that he laughs about it, the story of some youths, you know, asking him to show his his ID card. And
his
maybe
ID card.
Go ahead and say what he does.
Yeah. Well, they say, they follow him. He's going actually to the village of his biological father. There's this, you know, thing. I mean, Shona religion follows the paternal line,
right.
So it's important to check in with those people. And he goes to do that. And he's in a rural area, and they stop him and ask him for his ZANU PF card. And he's like talking back to them, and then he reaches into his glove compartment and pulls out his gun. And they run away. And then the cops come and find him at the home of his biological father, who's not there anymore, but the family. And they confiscate the gun and take it back to Harare. Oh, no, they keep it there, right? And he has to drive all the way back to Harare and get some sort of paperwork to come and reclaim it. And yeah, he
mm-hmm. But yeah,
makes
he
light
thinks
of it.
Kind of, yeah.
He makes light of it because it's like, oh, God, you know, I mean, compared to what other people are having to deal with, this is nothing.
Right.
But still, it's just a sign to him that life is just not going to be any
yeah.
fun there. It's just, if kids can come up and threaten him and demand that he show his party card, you know, it's like,
yeah.
Oh, I don't need that.
Right. But meanwhile, now 20, 30 years into his career, the music that he records in America is as good as anything, at least sound quality, Mbira, right? I mean,
it's been a challenge to keep a functioning band, and he's brought a lot of Americans into the band, which is interesting for a band called the Blacks Unlimited.
Because they're not all black.
They're definitely not all black. Sometimes they're
yeah.
more white people than black people. But you know, that's not what matters to him. You know, he's always had a very uncanny ear and just nose for good young musicians
uh-huh.
that he could really bring into his approach to music, which is very particular. You know, he doesn't want show-offs, he doesn't want hams, he doesn't want people with a lot of chops. He wants people who are going to really just get the deep vibe of the music
right.
and be able to find their place in this very collective sound. And the recordings, yeah, they're very good, the ones he's made here. It's
yeah,
true.
Maybe is there something you want to play of
yeah,
his
maybe,
exiles?
Yeah, maybe let's we could play this song that's right at the end of the Lion Song CD called Dangarira, which means remembering, and it's a very beautiful song. It's really a song of nostalgia. looking back at the country and missing it. Dangarira means remembering. Mm-hmm. And I should mention that he has a new album now called Danger Zone that just came out. That's very interesting. It's got some reggae songs on it. He does mm-hmm. he does a couple of singles with auto-tune, you know. He's wow. getting a lot of input from his kids who are mm-hmm. now grown and have lives in Oregon. And it's interesting. The whole family has become kind of bicultural. But yeah, it's nicely recorded, has really, really lovely songs. But this one, Dangarira, which is from just the one album just before that, which is called Exile, is lovely plaintive song, and you can hear how big the sound of the band is. There's just so many things going on in it. I actually play a guitar part in this song. I was great. At this session. But it's a lovely song. I think it's a good way to go out.
Yeah, all right, let's check it out. Wow, really gorgeous. I was saying off mic that to my ears, this late stuff in his career is as good as anything I've you know, to my own aesthetic taste. It's just beautiful. It's recorded beautifully. His voice sounds beautiful. The melodies are beautiful.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Well, you have to hear Danger Zone too.
Okay. Yeah, I'll check that out.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, there's I guess some speculation of where it's going to go from here.
I mean, I should know, right? But
well, no, you shouldn't know.
I can't tell you. I don't have a crystal ball, but you know, there's a theory that at some point Mugabe will die. I don't know. It's so far it hasn't panned out, you know. But I think that's what it'll take. I expect him to die in office. I really do. I don't think that he will ever relinquish power.
Now, do you think Thomas will read this book? Is he the type of guy to read a book on
himself? He has. His family has read it. We actually had quite a lot of back and forth when I sent the manuscript before it was published. Uh-huh. I made some changes on their request, and they corrected things.
Uh-huh.
It was worth doing, but it was a bit painful. He and his family, I think, were taken aback by the sort of thoroughness and honesty of the book. Maybe they were expecting something a little bit more sort of hagiography, just a praise song. I get into a lot of the different gnarly situations where people were critical of him for this or that,
right.
Musicians, political people, whatever it might be. And get into some sensitive areas of the whole family dynamic, which is complicated because of the parenthood issue that he has a different father.
And there's a separation at some point. There's a lot.
So it's true. He and his wife separate near the end, but they're actually back together now and quite harmonious at this point.
That's actually one of the sweet part of the book.
At the end.
That he softens, because it sounds like
he has softened. It's true.
That's really amazing, because he's such a tough guy. Yeah. It's true.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. The penultimate draft of this book had a much darker ending, and they kind of flipped. we had a rough 6 or 8 months actually. Yeah. And then I went out there and spent some time with them and saw the family in a much more settled and peaceful state out there. Uh-huh. And I've been out there subsequently, and it's holding. It's you know, it was really rough. Going into exile is hard, you know, and being separated from your country and your people and coming to a place where all the rules are different and a lot of things they didn't understand, and they got into a lot of issues with credit and this kind of stuff. And it created huge tension among various factions, and it was hard. It was hard on the kids. Yeah. It was hard on the marriage. It's hard on the band, everybody. But they've really come through it. So yeah, it ends in a much nicer place. I think at this point he feels good about it.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. And I was just curious. I mean, do you have a kind of philosophy that you stick with in terms of, you have these relationships with people and they're human beings and with their flaws and their positive sides, and then you go ahead and write a book. How do you decide what goes in, what goes out? Do you just, I mean, because I know if it's just flattery, then it's crap. It's not even worth reading.
And I guess I'd put it like this. I mean, I've only written two books that were about people this way, and this one is really the most. The first book I wrote about Mali, Jalamadi Tunkara, in Griot Time is the title.
Right.
Had some of these kinds of issues, but this one much more so, because it's a very thorough biography.
Yeah, well, and in Griot Time too. I mean, there you mentioned there's a domestic kind of incident.
Yes, there's a domestic violence.
I mean, how do you choose whether to leave that in or leave that out?
Well, in that case, I left it in because I felt that it was very revealing about his complex character, but also just about the pressure that his Gelamati's situation created as being the head of this huge household and having lost siblings and had their wives and kids move in. And there was just so much pressure on him. There were times when he would snap, you know, and I felt that it just seemed important to me to include that. And I don't think that I did it in a gratuitous way. And that didn't really cause any problem. He actually made a joke about it one time to me later, you know. I mean, Gelamati's a very... I mean, he can be stern too, but he's a really lighthearted person too. Right. He loves to, you know, he's extremely confident. He doesn't feel threatened about anything, you know. And Thomas is somewhat that way too. With Thomas, it was harder because it was as much the way his family, his wife and daughter in particular, who read every word of that manuscript and were really took exception to certain things in it. And that, of course, he, in his mode of defending them, became very, very, very riled about it at one point. And, you know, it was a tough time. Right. But in terms of how I think about it as a writer, I always knew that this was a possibility. I from the moment I decided to write this book, which was a long time ago, I've been working on it for many years, I decided that this was going, you know, I was writing the book because I love the guy. I love his music. I think he's tremendously important. I think it's a hugely overlooked African story and African life and career, and I wanted to really give it its due. But at the same time, it is a biography of a very complex person and a person who's been through a lot of controversies. And it just, I always knew that when I sat down to write, I wasn't looking to have any particular agenda. I certainly didn't want to tear him down or air his dirty laundry or anything like that, but it had to be an honest book. It had to really deal with these questions that anyone would have, you know, about how this band worked and how the whole dynamic of band and family, which is a big part of the story because he's had so many members of his family engaged in the management of the band. And in some ways it's a classic story, you know, it's the story of so many rock and roll stories, whether it's, you know, Ike and Tina Turner or James Brown or Ray Charles. There's always these issues of family and band. And this is a very particular one, but I was really determined to make a very full portrait, and I wasn't afraid to go into sensitive areas. Mm-hmm. And the line is, you know, when are you just being gratuitously dramatic, or when are you giving credence to someone who really may not be that credible? But I wasn't afraid. I felt that was important.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't be a good book if I was just going to whitewash stuff.
Right. Wow. So what's next?
Well,
two books, a bunch of recordings.
Yeah. I'll just remind folks that I'm going to be doing the Lion Songs presentation at Bar Bess on Sunday, the 12th. At 8 p.m. in Brooklyn. And you can go to my website, banningair.com, to find out more about that and other events and to order the book and CD if you want. What comes next? I don't have another book on the table.
That must
at the
be
moment.
A relief. A book seems like this huge stone on your back.
This was a tough one. And I have some ideas. My work with Afropop Worldwide is really demanding. We're doing a lot of traveling and heavily researched programs that are taking over a lot of my life. Publicizing this book has been a big part of my work this year. So I don't really know what book is going to come next. I will write another book. I have a few ideas, but I'm not quite sure. I'd like to try to write a book that would step back a little bit more from such an individual story and try to help write a book that would have a little bit more popular appeal and that would be more aimed at the general American music lover and listener and try to make them understand in a more comprehensive way why Africa is so important in our musical history and in terms of understanding our music. And just all those interconnections and really understanding how history, which is so much engaged with Africa because of our history with slavery, has shaped our music. And I just think there's so many of these revelations that people aren't really aware of. So one idea I have is to write a book that tries to really take that on and make it dramatic, visceral, understandable to just any reader.
Wow. All right. Well, that's an admirable goal, and yeah, it could be yeah. a good read.
And, oh, yeah. Well, I guarantee it'll be interesting and entertaining. That's always the bottom line. You know, I rely on scholars, but I'm not a scholar. I am a writer. You know, I want it to be fun to read and interesting to read. You know.
Yeah, I mean the equivalent is something like George Wein, my old boss, used to say. He said, "You can't have a festival without people." You know. It's like,
yes.
If no one's reading your book, it really doesn't matter.
No,
how
exactly.
Accurate it is.
And you know, and a lot of the work we do with Afropop, we work with scholars, and I read some of these books that are so interesting, but they're written in such a way that, you know. Most people would just get completely bogged down by page 20, yeah. You know.
All right. Well, thanks for all your work. And
well, thank you.
Yeah. There's so much people can delve into at afropop.org as well.
That's for sure.
And keep it up, man.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, David. Take care.
All right. How cool is that? So if you made it this far, you are a person of depth and substance, because this was a long podcast, but you will be amply rewarded. Check this out. You know so much about Thomas Mafumo. Here we are hanging out at a bar a couple years ago. Dig it, and take care. Enjoy.
It was during the 70s, early 70s, when our own people were fighting for freedom. When the Liberation War broke out in that country, that's when I started actually writing my own music.
Mm-hmm. And the soldiers, it meant a lot to them to hear these songs.
Oh yeah, that's true. I have a lot of fans within the army. Although I don't agree with the government, but musically, I have a lot of followers in the army, also within the police force, and the public itself.
Right. Well, the music is kind of undeniable, I think.
That's true.
If you have a heartbeat, you love the music.
Oh, yeah.
And then, did you have any worries that, I don't know, maybe this revolution won't work out, or I'm encouraging the wrong people, or you were confident that you were always doing the right thing?
No, I was very confident that I was still doing the right thing, even though the government which is there is a black government, but I still pointed out their mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we are not very good friends anyway.
Right.
But you know, I stand for the poor people. I'm like a messenger. And I'm coming from the poor people. And those are the people who put me where I am today. So I have to stand by them. And that's where I belong. I don't support corruption, whether it's done by a white government or a black government. I don't tolerate that.
And we had some music, Shona Imbira music, on the radio recently. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this musician, Forward Kwenda.
Forward Kwenda, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful, beautiful Imbira player.
Mm-hmm.
And he explained a lot about how the music in his family was used for to bring the spirits.
Yeah, that's so sure. Mbira music is for ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
It has something to do with our world of spirits, where some of our people are possessed by the spirits of their ancestors. And this is their instrument that, produces their music. It's used to be very sacred. It wasn't allowed to be recorded or to be put on tape or on record or to be played on radio. But, We were, I mean, the young generation of that day, and I thought this instrument was just like any other instrument that we use today to play music. So when I brought it and made a fusion of it with a modern instruments, it came out beautiful. So it's just like any other instrument, and I did a lot because today the world knows that there's an instrument called lira.
Yes, for sure.
Yes. So it's, I mean, it is important for cultural impact to bring this instrument overseas and make people listen to it. Yes.
And even though your lyrics had different meanings, do you think the music retained some of that maybe magical power that was in the, when it's used in the ceremony?
I think it will still remain the same. The same was spiritual, and it remains spiritual. It ain't gonna change.
And I wanted to ask about in 1980, you played the famous concert when Rhodesia was finally overthrown. I wonder if you had any memories of that concert, and I guess Bob Marley was there as well.
He was there. It was a great concert anyway. And it was my first time to listen to a live reggae group. And look who was there. It was him, the man himself, and we all enjoyed. He was so powerful. We played the same night, you know, we played, we were the last to play. We played at 4 o'clock in the morning. Everybody had gone, but the people who fought in the war, who fought from the bush, waited for the Plex Unlimited to play music. They danced until sunrise. So Bob Marley was really wonderful, and I still enjoy his music today because it has a very powerful message. And I think he was a freedom fighter, and his voice will remain, there forever and ever.
I've noticed in some of your music, sometimes you incorporate some of the reggae rhythm a little bit.
Oh yeah, because African music is almost like some of the reggae music that we listen to. And that's where, reggae is coming from. It's an African beat, but at the same time, my music is typically Zimbabwean, where most of it, it originated from the rural areas where I grew up as a herd boy, herding cattle and goats. I listened to a lot of traditional music, and my own grandparents were into traditional music. Mm-hmm. They played drums, drumming and singing, and also there was a lot of mbira music. So we listened to all that music, and there was the other type of music for the youth. That was the other type of music that I actually went through, and I'm very much experienced with traditional music. And that's where I'm coming from. But at the same time, when I came to stay in the city with my own parents, the very first time I listened to radio music, and that was my first time to listen to bigger names like Sister Miriam Makeba from South Africa, music from America, Frank Sinatra, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, name them, Blood, Sweat and Tears, Chicago, Brass Construction, and Sam Cooke, all those great guys,
like Nat King Cole. I was listening to all that music because I'm actually interested in good music. If the music is good, for me, it's right. But Bob Marley actually impressed me with his messages within his music. Those were very, very strong.
And you had, at times in your life, you had a lot of people listening to what you had to say, a lot of power, and you even spent some time in jail as well because mm-hmm. of your ideas.
Oh, yeah.
Did it ever, how did it feel to have suddenly going from a musician to becoming a political figure with so much?
Well, it just happened. I don't know really because I think my music made me that because the lyrics the lyrics within my music actually changed a lot of people. They even sent some young men out of the country to go out there, be trained, and come back fighting the white regime. Mm-hmm. It was because my music, they were influenced by my music. But then people gave me so many nicknames like the Lion of Zimbabwe, Nchadura, Kanya, all those are the nicknames that I got from my fans. The Lion of Zimbabwe means I'm fearless. Mm-hmm. I don't fear no one. So that's how that nickname came about. But at the same time, I think I had a role to play, and my music had a role to play too. I wanted to identify myself with my own people, and my music is like, the voice of the voiceless, those who cannot speak for themselves. The music is there to speak for them. And today we are not looking at the situation in Zimbabwe only. We're looking at the situation, concerning the rest of the world. There are problems that people are facing in this world today. People are at each other's throat, and we need to address that problem. People are supposed to live together. People are supposed to love one another. And people are as one in the eyes of God. And this is what some other issues that we need to address as musicians.
Well, thank you so much. I have one last question. We're on the radio in New York, but I also podcast. So that means I know a lot of your records are banned in Zimbabwe, mm-hmm. but maybe some people will be able to hear what you have to say through the internet. Okay. So I wonder if you have any messages for your people back home.
Yeah, well, I want them to know that one day I'm going to be back home and play music for them. And that's for sure. I'm well prepared for that because I'll be going to South Africa in October to play at some festivals and some other gigs that will be nearer home. Mm-hmm. And there are also a lot of Zimbabweans now living in South Africa. I've been there several weeks ago, and I was on the stage with Oliver Mtukudzi. I just played two songs. There were a lot of Zimbabweans screaming and scratching. And so they really need, the band to go back to Zimbabwe and play music.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for your lifetime of effort, and it's a real honor.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Thank you.